The most dangerous place you can be as a trial lawyer is to think you've got it figured out.
I'm still trying to get better. I still have the passion for it. I believe in it.
Everyone can learn to do what I do.
And yet there's a group here that continues to get extraordinary verdicts.
Trial Lawyers University is revolutionizing educating lawyers to be better trial lawyers. It's been invaluable to me.
Trial Lawyers University, where the Titans come to train. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
We got Russell Pate here from the U.S. Virgin Islands. Is that right?
From the Big Island of St. Croix.
The Big Island of St. Croix. And we are here at the Big Easy Lodge in Big Sky, Montana. And Nick Raleigh was kind enough to let us use his place so that we could do our ski camp and raise a little money to help defeat Uber, who's trying to destroy our civil justice system. So, Russ, this is your second boot camp, and you were there last year in Tahoe with us. And in the meantime, he went home and, amongst other things of living his life, went home and got himself a big jury trial verdict. And so that's one of the things we're going to talk about. And Russ is also an enigma because he, first of all, he lives in the U.S. Virgin, he lives in St. Croix, right? So anybody can live on an island is an enigma. But he also likes to get involved in litigation that lasts more than 10 years and put all of his life savings and wait and wait and wait. So he's an enigma of patience too. So Russ, what's your favorite part of ski camp since this is your second time?
Oh, favorite part of ski camp? Well, I mean, you're having some fun and you're learning. And then it's also the team that you're meeting. I mean, if you're not out there every day trying to learn and better yourself, and you've already peaked. I mean, you're the best you're ever gonna be. So, I mean, Dan, you bring together the top people to learn from. I mean, you're standing on the shoulders of giants with the attorneys winning these big verdicts and being willing to teach. So, I mean, I'm just here to learn, you know, be at the altar of trial law learning.
Yeah, and and I appreciate that. But that's mostly what I think the bigger conferences, like TLU Huntington Beach, and your first conference was the Vegas conference at Caesar's Palace, where it's like we have, you know, Huntington Beach, we got 5 lecture tracks, 7 workshop tracks. And so we really do have a collection of the greatest lawyers coming in from all parts of the country, all different areas of law, between personal injury, medical malpractice, employment law, civil rights, trucking, you know, some specialties, and, you know, people that have been just out there in the trenches, trying cases, mm-hmm. trying new stuff, being innovative, seeing what works, what doesn't work, doing, you know, you utilizing different types of focus groups to figure these cases out. But this here at ski camp, or my boot camps, is really about training the physical skills of being mm-hmm. a trial lawyer. That's really trains the intellectual skills, because mm-hmm. most of it is sitting and watching. Not all of it, because we have the workshops where we do the physical skills, and we even teach the stuff that we teach here, the cross-examination skills, the witness prepping, the performance skills, which are opening statement and closing argument, and of course the voir dire skills, I consider to be kind of 4 separate subsets of being a trial lawyer, but all related. And really the relation is each one of these skills, when refined, is all about helping the trial lawyer connect with first their client, because you have to get the client's story from them. If you don't get the client's real story, then you're just making shit up, and maybe it's right, maybe it's not. But if it's not, then the client feels very disconnected with the lawyer and the story, because it's not their story. So he's telling a story about you, and you're like, wait a minute, that's not the way it happened. It's like you were there, but that's not what happened. Let me tell you what happened. And that's, I think, you know, part of our job, part of our calling, is to be the, you know, maybe the oracle, or obviously the voice for the client, because they're so, you know, typically, you know, traumatized. The last thing they want to do is talk about what happened to them.
Well, I mean, we represent people at their worst. I mean, most people who are injured are going to be, you know, they've got their family, they've got their job, they're a working person, and you've caught them at their worst, and they're not a person who's been able to speak in front of public. They don't know these legal concepts. So you are truly the medieval knight. You're coming in to help the little village against, you know, the horde. And that's, and to go back to your boot camp, yes, this boot camp, I think, is so important for almost every lawyer to experience, because, you know, 99% of your practice, you're sitting in front of the computer, you're drafting motions, you might be doing some depositions, you're being very lawyerly. And your boot camp here, and I'll try to summarize it, it teaches you to actually, before you speak, have a warm, happy face. And that's something I still very struggle with. I come off too serious. And before I stand up, even to question or give opening or closing, direct, I think warm face, warm face. And from that, it prompts the rest of the training, that you're making the eye connection with each of your jurors. And so you're training, you know, if you have a 6-person jury, you have 2 alternates maybe 3, depending on the trial. Maybe you're in a state that has 12 and you've got a long trial, 3 months, you may have 6 or 7 alternates. So you're needing to look at almost 18 people and to make that eye contact and then coordinate your movements, you know, synchronized with your eye contact, your speaking, your breathing, your warm face, and all of that. You can't do that. You can't be thrown into a baseball game and hit 100-mile-an-hour fastball if you hadn't been practicing all these smaller skills. And that's what the training does. And it's so important. Even if you only come once, it's going to be in your mind that you're going to, as you say, Dan, you practice it at the grocery store. You practice it with your friends. So once you at least have the concepts and the vocabulary, and this is what always amazes me about lawyers that are like not learning, you know, they've peaked already. But if you're constantly learning, then you're constantly improving, and everything you do, you can improve an area of law, whether you're being more human when you relate to people, or you're being more technical on knowing more of your rules of procedure, or tricks of depositions and everything else. And that's, you bring together the giants. And so every person who comes in that's won these big verdicts, they have something to show you at some level that you can incorporate.
And, you know, this training, I really can, and I've heard this expression once, can't remember, it said, all of learning is pattern recognition. And so when you train and you repeat the same patterns over and over so that you can do them just like swinging a golf club without thinking, well, then you really understand pattern recognition. And then when you interact with others or you're listening to somebody tell you a story from their life, you will see all of these, everything that we learn here, you know, is like when they're telling a story from their own life, you'll see their eyes go avert into their head, access the image, their faces change to match whatever, to be congruent with every story. They'll be like, you know, this guy, he comes in and like, he doesn't have to say, you're not gonna believe this, because his face, his emotional congruence is telling you, you're not gonna believe this, right? And so as you train every day, every conversation, you're watching people and you're seeing, you know, all the patterns. There's an expression that the trained mind sees patterns where the untrained mind only saw randomness. Yep. And that's what the effect of training is in whatever it is that we're training. Here we're training trial performance skills. You know, whether, you know, and it doesn't matter, it's the purpose of training.
Absolutely. I mean, the next thing too is vocabulary. Anybody who's an expert, they generate vocabulary that's expert vocabulary. Why? Because you can't communicate with other people in your class of expertise if you don't have a vocabulary for everything. So you'll meet lawyers that haven't, you know, they haven't had, you know, your trial skills or these understandings. They'll say, oh, I did this at trial and I did this and I got this verdict. And you're like, don't you understand what you were doing? You were creating a binary choice. What? Oh, you were polarizing. Oh, I was what? I'm like, oh, don't you understand you were establishing credibility there? And they don't have the vocabulary to understand what they did. It's like a baseball player. It's always like somebody who grew up, it was always been easy. They've just been the star of their high school team and their college team. And then you get in the pros and you just think that, you know, it's always happened. But at the pro level, at the highest level, you've got to have that understanding of vocabulary. And when you get in with these other lawyers, and that's what you're doing. By creating a process, we have words for certain things, for concepts and ideas. And then you're able to implement them with an educated understanding.
TLU Huntington Beach is going to be the greatest event of 2026. There's going to be 4 lecture tracks, 8 workshop tracks with the top trial lawyers in the country. On Tuesday, June 2nd, there's going to be a golf outing and also a pickleball outing. That night, we're going to have a dinner at the La Rea. We're going to buy it out so everybody gets a chance to meet each other beforehand. And then during the conference, of course, we do a full breakfast, full lunch, and theme parties every night. This year, we're going to be utilizing the pool area and the restaurant for more of the parties. And we're going to have an adult swim right one night, a Satch Oliver party on Friday night. And the last theme party is going to be a 80s Run DMC Adidas jumpsuit. It's going to be the greatest. And last year we had over 800 people. This year it's going to be over 1,000. So if you want to be part of it all and you want to stay at the Paseo Hotel, don't delay because it sells out fast and then you're going to be in the overflow. Can't wait to see you there. TLU Beach.
So, Russell, how did you, because I know that you don't come from a long family tradition of lawyers like I do, because my dad was a lawyer and two of my older brothers and my sister were all lawyers. So how did you get into this or decide you wanted to be a lawyer?
Okay. Yeah, I come from a family of doctors. So, my mom's father was a doctor and my dad's father was a doctor. And then my dad was a doctor with his brothers. And my dad was pretty much the smartest person I ever knew. You know, he skipped 2 years in high school and he got a scholarship to Tulane that was like a half scholarship. So I said, well, I'll just do all my classes in 2 years. And so, I mean, this is back before you had like you caps on your hours. So he just took like, 30 hours each semester and like literally rented out his dorm room to somebody else, sold his meal plan. I mean, and crushed it through college. I don't think he actually graduated high school or college, but he got into medical school at essentially like Doogie Howser, like 18. And he applied to these medical schools and only one medical school. They were all like, you're too young. And one of the deans said to him you're a gunner. I want you. And so, he gets in and he's the smartest. I mean, he has like a photographic memory. So growing up the whole time, I thought there's no way if you have to be this smart to be a doctor, there's no way I can do that. Though, I mean, I used to go, he'd take me into the hospital back in the 90s and I'd see him operate. I'd be in the room with him. You'd see the terrible stuff because he was like he's the guy you wanted when you had like a horrible crash on the road and you were mangled. Like he's putting you back together, putting your intestines back in, pumping your heart. I mean, like all that stuff. And I just thought, I don't think I'm smart enough to do that.
I don't think I have the stomach for it.
Yeah.
I remember my dad wanted me to be a doctor. And so I just remember taking a look at my first chemistry class and smelling that stuff. And then, having to take care of all these human, the stuff that my blood and shit, all that, like, ugh.
The smells are the worst. In surgery, you have a cauterizer. It's like it's instead of a scalpel in olden days, the knife, like it's actually like a electric burner and you can cut people open with it and actually like burn the skin back. And that smell just like gave me like such nausea, but the blood was fine. I mean, we were standing in like the blood all across the floor, blood shooting. I mean, I got spurted from like an aorta. I mean, that was okay. But I just, he could do math in his head. He'd be, I'd pull a calculator out and he'd be like, well, what do you need a calculator for?
All right, so we established you're not smart enough to be a doctor and you don't have a stomach for it. So this lawyer thing though.
Yeah.
There was a lot of other things you could do. You could be an engineer, you could be an accountant.
No, you didn't have
to be a lawyer.
No, I didn't have the math. I my dad was always telling me, we were in Texas at that time and this is before kind of the tort cap. So he'd been telling me these stories about Joe Jamail and his Texaco verdict, Racehorse Haynes, Marvin Belli. And at this point, with medicine, it was getting more restricted where, insurance companies are running medicine, lawyers are running hospitals. So, my dad would, let's say there was like a breast cancer. He would, cut the breast cancer out and instead of just leaving the breast for a plastic surgeon, he'd like fix the woman's breast nicely. And then if she had a hernia, he'd like fix the hernia. Or if there's a big mole on the person's neck, he'd take it off. And he would do that all in one surgery. And then the bureaucracy became where they'd say, oh, you can't do all those at once. Like you have to put them back down so we can bill it again. And he's like, I'm not doing that. That's not good for the patient. So he would do these things and just not get paid for all the extra work. And he was fine with it. And then finally it came a day where like, you can't do it at all. It's, not unethical, but against our protocols. And I mean, it was just him trying to treat the patient versus the bureaucracy of the hospital. And he just said, it's not worth to go in medicine anymore. You're constrained.
Okay, so law, but yeah. So how did you decide to become a lawyer?
I think that was it. I looked at it as, my dad always was fighting for the underdog. He was a very non-materialistic guy. So, I mean, he was gonna do a surgery on like a homeless guy and my dad was had a pair of boots that pretty much he nailed back together and duct taped. Even as a doctor, he wouldn't let him go. And the homeless guy goes, "Doc, I can't pay you." And he said, "Oh, don't worry. You don't have to pay me. This is free." And the homeless guy says, "Well, Doc, I want you to take my boots because they're better than yours." You know, so he always stuck up for the underdog. And I kind of thought I'd be interested in that. So, but my grades weren't really that good. I'd always thought of college as, you know, it's more about the learning and not much about the grades. It's more the discovery process. So coming out, my dad had told me this story, "Son, you know, you can apply to any college you want, but the only school I'm going to pay for is Chapel Hill." And that's because it was the state school. You know, I mean, it was like $3,000 a year. And then when I wanted to apply to law school, he looked at me and said, "Son, you can apply to any law school you want to, and you can pay for it." So then it really hits you hard. I'd been looking at, you know, all these law schools, and you find out, oh, God, you know, not that I could ever get into Duke, but you're like, Duke, $50,000 a year, University of Chicago, $50,000. So I look back at Chapel Hill, and I'm like, oh, my God, I got to get in there. But my grades weren't that good. So, I mean, I just went down every day to the admissions lady. I was head of the pre-law at that time for undergrad. So I'd figure out something that I could go talk to her about. I'd bring her a little gift. She was pregnant. And I just, you know, there's a lot to be said when you're starting out to kiss some butt. Like, you really need to
be a schmoozer.
Yeah, schmooze, kiss butt, make connections. And, you know, people want to work, just like you say, people want to work and refer to other people that they like and they're friends with. And that's social dynamics. Like, what's wrong with that? That's evolution throughout history.
So you go to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, for law school, and you get through law school. Did you do anything in law school that kind of, did you do like trial ad or moot court and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, what I did in law school was probably do everything wrong. So, I mean, it started with, I was dating a girl in undergrad, and so she ends up, you know, I'm like, oh, well, when does college start for her? And I go up to school with her, and it turns out I missed the first week of law school. And so I missed, you know, oh, you're supposed to have a study group. Oh, you're supposed to answer the exams through this thing called like IRAC, issue, rule, analysis, conclusion. I had no clue. I was just thinking this is the greatest, like, you know, you're learning all this stuff. But I didn't know what an appellate opinion was. Like, we read these case opinions. I have no concept that it's like an appeal. I didn't know what a motion to dismiss or summary judgment standard was, or I was clueless. So my first semester exams, like, they were horrible. I mean, I don't know if I was last in the class, but it was low. It was really bad.
Well, must be good you finally got through it all.
I mean, and it's the classic thing, like, my worst grades were in torts. I mean, it's like a humorous example of, you know, good thing that to be a plaintiff trial lawyer, you don't have to graduate from Harvard and be top of the class.
No. In fact, that'd probably be detrimental.
Yep.
Too intellectual, not enough humanity. But after you get out of law school, where do you land your first job?
Well, in law school, I didn't go through the, you know, you're supposed to do these interviews and all this stuff, and I didn't have the grades for that. And then the one time that I go to an interview, the guy says, "Well, I took your interview only because I'm going to be a friend to you. It's not trial law, it's trial law." And I'd had like a spelling mistake on that. I'm like, God, this is not working. So my one interview was the guy just to be like, and actually, you know, you feel so hurt on that, but he was doing me such a favor to tell me, look, you even have spelling errors on your resume. So I thought, I'll just apply to like a million different places and I'll go to these conferences. I'll go to the AHA conference, I'll go to the ABA, I'll meet lawyers and they'll see how hungry I am. And again, and I sent out like 1,000 letters to work at places. And I got like a stack back of like 300, like, thank you, we received your thing, no thanks. But I did an ABA meeting in New York, and then I went to Brussels in Belgium, and that's where I met a lawyer from the United Nations who just got hired by Simmons Cooper, you know, the biggest, bestest firm. Now it's Simmons, Hanley Conroy. And at that point, you know, they're trying to do some work in South Africa. And I said, I'll be happy to do some legal research. And so I just kind of was doing legal research for them in law school, and got to you know, pass that work up. Yeah, and it helped. I won from a paper, legal research paper I did for kind of helping that firm. I then published it, and I find out like 6 months later, I made three grand. The Texas State Bar Journal said, "Oh, you're the law student publishing. You got first place," and so I got $3,000 out of it.
Wow!
And then ended up going to work for them for my second year summer, and then I thought, hey, I'm cruising through this. I did it my way, and I'm going to end up working at a plaintiff firm after I graduate law school, my 3L year. And you know, right into my spring semester, I get a call from the attorney that I was working for and says, I've been fired or let go or whatever. And so when I called Simmons Cooper, they're like, who are you? So at that point, I'm like, I don't have a job and everybody else is locked in. And so, of course, that gives you a lot of heartburn. And, you know, you're at that point, your like world is falling apart. So I applied for a LLM at California Western and it was on trial ad. And so I ended up going out to California Western and they did a one semester training program out there in San Diego. And then the second semester, they place you into like a public defender's office, federal. So I asked to be placed in Dallas because I had some family there. And so I got placed into the Dallas Federal Public Defender's Office. And I got, it was a great experience. They had me match up as a second chair with kind of one of the attorneys there. I might miss it, but I think it was Sam Ogden. And he had classic like Texas handlebar mustache. And he was an old pro at what he was doing. And so we did one Ponzi scheme fraud case defense and like three child porn. Like, and when I say child porn, it's like collection of these guys that sit in their mom or grandma's basement and just collect porn.
Join us April 15th and 16th in Hermosa Beach, California at the TLU Beach House. We are doing a 2-day witness prep and direct examination workshop. The witness prep will teach you not only how to get your clients to remember their stories, but to relive them. And then the direct examination, so the jury just doesn't hear the story, but they experience it. They witness it. And this is right before Nick Reilly's trial by human in West Hollywood, April 17th through 19th. So come for the witness prep, stay for trial by human. We'll see you there.
Sounds like inspirational work there. So after, how long does that stint last for?
Well, that was, you know, I'm doing that for the semester, so about 5 months. And okay. And you do some of the motion practice. I mean, you're the lowest person on the totem pole and you're working as an internship for free, but it got you into the courtroom. And I mean, the big issue on that, you always try to rationalize, how are you helping? And at that point, you know, the federal government, the US Attorney's Office, I mean, they were asking for like 20 years for these guys that just collected, you know, they didn't just collect child porn, they collected all sorts of porn. I mean, it was every midget to horse. Midget the horse, whatever you can think about. And you have to, the worst part is you had to review the little thumbnail, the really small one, to just make sure that it was terrible. But be like, okay, that's not child porn, that's like a horse. And then you'd be like, there's only, you know, 200 images to like rebut on the government. But they were getting, you know, 20 years. And at the same time in Texas, you know, somebody would go out and really like rape somebody and they get 7 years. So you could rationalize your defense as, you know, a part of justice, that the punishment is just disproportionate to the harm. But after that, the public defender there, amazing guy, Richard Anderson, told me, hey, you guys did a great job. And I'm like, did a great job? Like, we lost like every one of our cases. The guys got slammed. And he's like, I know, but the US attorney there is now giving us better plea offers. Like, that's a win. And that, I think that really helped me as an attorney to realize that the win is what you're, you know, the win is not what you think. You know, there's clients that you get low settlements for and they're very happy. And there's clients you knock it out of the park and they're unhappy. So it's really client expectation. It's not, you know, you have your internal drive, but you're judged on the expectation of your clients or your boss. And so the boss said, well, you did great. We want to send you up to Amarillo in the Northern District of Texas, because that U.S. attorney up there is all in on this now, and he's wanting to do these child porn cases. So at that point, you know, I wasn't really enjoying the big city. I'd always been kind of a small town guy, and I thought, all right, I'm really not liking Dallas, and I really don't know if I want to go out to the middle of the panhandle.
It would have been a small town that you were looking for.
Well, Amarillo is actually, it's a pretty big place, actually, compared to little towns of like 10,000 people. Okay. I don't know what Amarillo is now, but I think it's over 250,000. And so at that point, I just was like, one last ditch. I sent out again like a million resumes. I mean, I feel like I sent them one to like American Samoa and the North Mariana Islands and Palau and the Channel Islands. And my mom's from Aruba, so I sent some resumes down to the Caribbean, to the Virgin Islands. And I had a call back from an attorney on St. Thomas, That's our cruise ship island. And he was interested in me because I'd done some asbestos work. And it was an insurance defense firm. And there's a big refinery on St. Croix. It was actually the largest refinery in the Western Hemisphere, the Hess Oil Refinery. And he said, hey, I'm interested in this. We do some refinery litigation defense work. But, you know, in the Virgin Islands, it's not just an interview. I need you to come down for 3 weeks, and I got to give you a test run. Because, you know, not a lot of people can't hack it down here. So I was, you know, I said, okay, I'll fly down and do my tour of duty. And that's when I ended up flying down in April or May of 2008.
So it was a thriving time to come out and look for a job.
It was, yeah, that was the Great Recession. So yeah. No surprise that all of the things I sent out, that there was no offers back. So I'm doing my 3 week trial run and seeing I'm not getting any offers back. And I said, okay, I think that, you know, this Virgin Islands might be the place. At least I've got like a steady job and it's, you know, litigation work.
And so how long do you stay with this fellow or this defense for?
So I was there not quite 2 years. At about a year and a half, they'd lost a big insurance client. So I got kind of a nice, you know, farewell that said, hey, you can keep working here, but you're going to run out of hours. And so you're gonna start making less and less because you're not able to bill on this stuff. And the you know, my boss had said, you know, I can write you a letter of recommendation for a clerkship, because the Virgin Islands, actually all judges have clerks. The trial court judges have clerks. We follow the federal model. So all of them write like these giant memorandum opinions. I mean, you get full published opinions at the state level. And I probably should have clerked. I just was too naive at that time. And I didn't really want to switch to a defense firm. I actually didn't really like law because it was so boring. That year and a half, I mean, you're just doing what defense firms do, like objecting to discovery responses, moving to compel, you know, filing motions to dismiss, just anything you can do to, you know, stop the train to trial. So I called my dad up and I said, Dad, you know, I hate law. This has been terrible. I want to go travel from South Africa to Sweden and, you know, maybe I'll figure some stuff out to do that's law related while I'm traveling. You know, there's a pause on the side of the phone. Son, there was a time and a place for that. It's called college. That's over. You need to work, get a job. I'm like, well, Dad, I mean, if I start an office, I have like no clients. I don't really have any money. I mean, it's like really expensive. I'll probably go into a huge amount of debt. I'll be bankrupt. I mean, I'll have like credit card companies chasing me. Kind of a little pause again. Well, son, then you can run to Africa. They probably won't find you there. I'm like, okay, well, and that was the thing. I went out and was like, okay, how am I going to do this? And I looked around for, you know, office space and, you know, you look at the first place and, oh, $5,000 a month. And I'm like, oh my God. And then you go to another place, $3,000 a month. Oh my God. And the next place, $1,500 a month. And I'm like, oh, that's still even more than my like rent for my little, you know, apartment. And so finally I find, you know, the cheapest seats in like one of the oldest buildings in downtown St. Thomas. And they say $500 a month. And I'm like, okay, I think I can do that. But I mean, I had a hard time watching Better Call Saul because, I mean, like that, my office was like a little bit on par with his little office at the back of the nail salon. You know, you walked up these like very sketchy, back rotten wooden steps, which you could never bring a client there that's injured. And then you walk out and you go in this like third floor shed and the carpet's moldy and the walls have stuff, you know, growing on them and, you know, AC units with rocks in them. And that's not even talking about the army of cockroaches.
So you find your new office and then tell us about how you go about start to get clients and what you start looking for.
You know, a lot of times you have to have a certain level of naivety and hope that anybody else just says, you know, this is idiotic. And you kind of persevere. It's kind of like the young adventurer that leaves the hometown for, you know, glory. And you have no like real sword. You have no real shield. You know, you don't have a horse. You have like a donkey. And so, I mean, that was, I the newspaper had just had like a new deal on advertising. So I'd sat down and I'd made my little manifesto for my office.
So Russell, you start advertising for the cases that are your target dream cases, the asbestos, the tobacco, the class actions. And obviously those are all big picture, long-term projects. But and of course you have to pay the bills. And so you start doing some form of what we call in the law business, street law.
Absolutely.
If it walks in off the street and you can handle it, you do it. So what kind of cases were you handling as a street lawyer before you started to be able to move the asbestos case and stuff forward?
Oh, it's just a crazy mix. I mean, we have a wrongful discharge statute, kind of like a labor employment statute, maybe like California. So I did some wrongful discharge. For some reason, it must have been a dog bite epidemic in the Virgin Islands. I had dog bite cases out the wazoo. The issue there is finding a homeowner's insurance policy. That's difficult. And I even had an iguana bite case. So I haven't found another lawyer that's handled an iguana bite case.
I haven't met another lawyer that's handled an iguana. I knew when I met you, I was like, this guy's special. Didn't know why, but it's the iguana bite case.
Yeah. And then ended up having, you know, you had a lot of different premises liability. Our car insurance insurance is so low. It's just 10-20 policies. So
Still.
So, I mean, the saddest thing here is if you actually have somebody that has serious injuries, you cannot make them happy. There is no, you can't actually take the case. If they need a $50,000 surgery and there's a $10,000 policy and the person has no assets, what are you going to do for them? Like, taking the case, actually, you become the bad guy. You will be blamed because there's no outlet for the
right.
for the person who's hurt.
How about criminal law? Any criminal law?
Oh, yeah. Oh, goodness. Well, thank you for bringing that up, Dan. So, yeah, we're talking about me starting my office, and I think I finished with, you know all the roaches. So, but while I'm sitting, I had there were so many roaches, they ate my law books that I put into my, in my new office. It came in and the bindings were all eaten out. And I learned that, okay, roaches actually eat glue and they will destroy your books. And so I bug bomb it. I come back in the week after it's bug bombed, you know, clean out two giant garbage bags of roaches from my office, sit down at my desk. And I'm like, okay, what am I going to do now? Like, I'm here, but when's the phone
and
gonna ring?
And you're almost roach-free.
Yeah.
So that's a big start.
And while I'm sitting there being like, how do I get the phone to ring? I get a phone call, and the court clerk says, is this Russell Pate? Yes. We've been trying to reach you at your last office. Okay, yeah, I've moved. This is my new office. I just started it. Well, you need to hurry down to court. You've just been appointed a murder case. And I'm like, oh. It's like, yeah, he's in lockup right now, and they're going to have advice of rights soon. And I'm like, okay, I, you know, put on my suit and tie and walk down to court. And that was my first client, Jody
Penn. Was that your first criminal case?
Me as a first chair, yeah. I mean, I had done some of that. We had those
in the public defender's office.
Four cases where I'm second chair. But yeah, you know, it's funny because in the Virgin Islands, every member of the bar can be appointed a criminal case. And there's actually a high per capita murder rate and rate of violence. I mean, we're at or above like downtown Chicago or New Orleans. So it's, you know, people think, oh, it's paradise. But it's a confluence of kind of the drug trade and personal grievances and you know, kind of everybody knowing everybody. And so I get my murder case appointed. And you would think when you tell the judges, well, I've never done, you know, I come in and meet with the judge the first time. And I'm like, Your Honor, I've never done a criminal case before. And this is a murder case. And the judge just looks at you and goes, well, you're young and you're ambitious. And, you know, I found out that the young new lawyers do a whole lot better job. They do more detailed work than the older lawyers that are jaded on this. And I'm like, okay.
So much for getting yourself out of that murder case.
Mm-mm. And I mean, I've had, over time, I've had, I think it's eight murder appointments. Or, well, maybe two attempted murders and six other like murder cases. And we've tried... I remember specifically trying two cases and having kind of a mixed verdict. So it was not, you know, it was a lesser included. It was nice to be in the courtroom, but I prefer civil law because, you know, I like, it's a small community that you're living in down there. And already we have, you know, a high crime rate and I enjoy, you know, taking and helping the person who was the family man who went to work every day and then something bad happened to them and they were doing their part and now you're being their champion. And I just feel like, you know, that's
better than trying to save a very bad person from 30 years and maybe get them 10 years and they're still a very bad person. And
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, most of the time, by the time you represent the criminal defendant, they're very nice to you. So, I mean, you have, you know, they're, when you meet them and you're their champion, I've never had an issue where any of the criminal defendants I was appointed were bad or mean to me. You know, they're very interested in winning their case.
Oh, no, absolutely. Not that they're bad or mean, it's just that, you know, I did criminal defense for 17 years, like, zealously, religiously, it was my life. And let me just tell you, or anybody that's like, it's a hard life. It is the most stressful job. And it's even worse when they're innocent. Nothing worse than an innocent man to make you lose sleep, lose your appetite, lose everything. And all you do is focus on them. And it just, it's so detrimental for your business too, because you don't think about making money if you have somebody's life in your hands. All you're just trying to do is work your ass off. And then, you know, if you truly believe in somebody and things don't go your way in a trial and you see that person let out of the courtroom in handcuffs, you know they're gonna be in prison for 10 or 15 years because you weren't good enough. Man, I know why people, you know, a lot of these lawyers drink so much, because it's a lot to deal with.
Dan, I will one up you on that for what's worse than that criminal defense.
Divorce work.
That's the most dangerous for lawyers if you're gonna get, you know, threatened or shot, is usually divorce work or child custody work. But you've now made me remember, I had a court appointment that was guardia ad litem to an 10-month or 9-month-old that a man, boyfriend, or whatever, had grabbed by the legs and slammed against a concrete wall. And so I went into the hospital, and the baby had a giant hematoma off its head. And it's, you kind of repress those.
Yeah.
And you know, that is something that is just so horrible, and I'm representing the interests of the baby in kind of this criminal custody issue. It was a huge family court mess, and I realize, you know, I never want to see that again. And we know what we do. You think of the doctors that see that every day and the court system, you know, you have to get numb to it. Like you said, doctors that are lawyers that become drinkers.
April 21st through 25th in Hermosa Beach, California, we're hosting a boot camp where you will train in the fundamental skills of trial, witness prep and direct, cross-examination, performance skills, which are opening statement and closing argument, and jury selection, or voir dire, depending on where you live. You're going to focus on eye contact, voice control, emotional state control, hand and body movement, glance control, creating space, amongst other skills. And then once you learn these skills, we're going to apply them to your case. So at the end of the day, it's an investment and a case expense. This program will fundamentally change your life.
So you eventually get your cases going that you want to do, the mass torts, the asbestos. So so how do you go about, you know, because one of the things that fascinates me about you is the fact that you just figure shit out, like, you know, Epstein. I mean, one of the most prolific, horrible human beings ever, but that's one thing. But what did you... You know, how are you down there in that neighborhood? His little island was somewhere near you. Yeah. So when all this started happening in 2018, what did you do?
So that's interesting. So, you know, I had done my asbestos and tobacco cases, and I remember, you know, all this Epstein stuff happening in the news. And I'm a lot of lawyers in the Virgin Islands that handle tax credit work. You know, it's a small pond, so they had dealings with Jeffrey Epstein on the either, you know, real estate or charity giving or tax credits and stuff like that. But I'm a poor person lawyer. I'm like a normal person lawyer, so I never had any of those dealings. But my dad had called me up when Epstein was arrested, and he's like, that bastard guy, you need to figure out a way to sue him. This is what you do. He's, you know, he lives down there half the time. Like, can't you figure out a way to sue him? And I told my dad, I said, look, I don't have any clients. You know, you need to have a victim. And, you know, these lawyers in the States all have victims. And a little bit later, and depending on what conspiracy theory you believe, Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide in prison. And at that point, I'm like, all right, so it's his estate now. And the estate was being opened up in the Virgin Islands. And I just really try to think of creative ways. And I'm like, this dude was using all these tax credits to, like, essentially for misuse. Like, we have a tax credit program in the Virgin Islands that people can come down there and create business and do local hires and give to charity and kind of like grow your business there and have some tax credits. And he was using them to facilitate his, you know, trafficking that he did between Florida, New Mexico, Europe, and New York. So that was one of these things that I worked with the local attorney general's office to figure out, you know, is, you know, from my knowledge of kind of civil practice and complex litigation, that you don't really have that experience, you know, in these criminal offices, the complex civil litigation. And you see all these states now, they, when they do a big complex case, if they're suing opioids or Johnson & Johnson or Big Pharma or even the tobacco companies, you bring in like the best of the best on the civil side. So I worked with Motley Rice and the AG. I mean, she's a hero, Denise George. And I'm really proud of that work, because if you look back, Florida had the most abuse for the girls. I mean, Epstein had 400 something teenage girls in high school that he'd bring them in on massages and pay them cash. And then, you know, from there create, do the molestation. And that's the epicenter in Florida. New York was his second place, because he had his penthouse off of Central Park, and he had a whole condo owned by his brother that he would lodge his girls there and chauffeur them over to his house. And he had a set of doctors that could give them gynecological appointments and birth control and abortions. And then you had New Mexico, where he had his ranch out there. And then he'd go over to France. And if you look at all these other states and even the federal government, the jurisdictions, Florida botched his prosecution. I mean, they gave him the biggest sweetheart deal imaginable. The feds took that over, and it was Alex Acosta, who's the U.S. attorney, gave him a sweetheart deal. And it was only the Southern District in New York that ended up trying to take up the Epstein prosecution years later, and then the Ghislaine Maxwell prosecution. And I mean, if you don't look outside of that, you had the heroes, the civil lawyers, particularly like Brad Edwards, who, I mean, read his book, buy Relentless Pursuit by Brad Edwards, and see what Jeffrey Epstein tried to do to a civil lawyer. This man went through 10 years of Epstein trying to tar and feather and bankrupt him, and he stayed the course. My life is easy compared to what Brad Edwards did for these victims. But on our side, I try to tout what the Virgin Islands did, because through our case, we're the only jurisdiction to make a pot of money for the victims. And I can't remember now, but I mean, I think it was like $135 million that was put together as a victims fund. And like 100, I can't remember exactly, but over, you know, there are some numbers on this, but over 100 women were able to have claims on that. And outside of the civil justice system, private civil justice system, the Virgin Islands is the only thing, the only state or territory to do anything for the victims.
And so you get involved with that, and now that litigation's concluded. That only took a few years.
Yes, I mean, there's tangentially, you know, J.P. Morgan was brought in on kind of its lack of oversight with Jeffrey Epstein using their bank accounts for paying settlements to the victims. Leon Black, you know, kind of had paid a settlement. So there's other civil litigation, and who knows? I mean, I still think of, in my mind, there's still, I believe, legal theories and liability out there potentially, but you know, it's. I think people feel like it's run its course, but I'm kind of like, I guess, a West Texas oilman, where I think, well, the well might not, well, it looks like it's dry, right, but if we frack it, you can find some more if you just are creative and come from a different angle. But,
well, just backing up again, as like I got sidetracked there, because like your asbestos and tobacco litigation. So from the time you started filing those, when did you get your first asbestos cases?
So, you know, if you come out of law school, I mean, this is, law school teaches you nothing. I mean, you don't even draft a complaint.
Yeah, everybody knows that. So, teach you how to pass a bar, if that. And the rest of it, terrible waste of time.
And I'm just amazed on your, you know, you really want to mentor people, and it's pretty much charity. You tell law students, like, you can come to my events, like, help work, and you can see, like, the real practice of civil law. And even at your boot camp here, you had a law student. I'm amazed. I mean, it's a kid in law school here learning some of the skills. And my talking to him is, listen, they're not going to teach you in law school if you want to be a plaintiff lawyer. You need two things. You need the ability to get clients, plaintiffs, and that's super difficult because you've got these giant billboards, you've got TV commercials, you've got social media, and these firms are putting in millions of dollars a year and they're sucking it all up. So, I mean, you're not taught, like, how do you find clients? And you don't understand anything about referral fees and how you're losing all this money because you get a client and you already owe somebody else 50% of your recovery, up to 50%. And then the next thing is, where's your war chest? I feel terrible. You kids come out of law school and you're like, oh, I want to do plaintiff law. I'm like, do you have $300,000 in the bank? Is your family wealthy? No, no, no. Well, how are you going to fund your cases? How can you look at a client and say, I can help you when you don't have the 50 to 100 to 150 grand to get a personal injury case to trial? And that was the problem. You have to have this naivety. And that was me starting my own office. I had so much naivety that I just assumed somehow, some way I'm going to be able to do it. And I thought, well, if I don't have the money, I'll get the clients. It's kind of like Field of Dreams. If you build it,
they will come.
So I started advertising. I started keeping my database of the potential tobacco clients and my potential asbestos clients. And I pulled off, you know, the plaintiff's hot 100. And every day I'd sit down and I'd make five phone calls. And I'd call the firm and I'd give my pitch. Here's the tobacco cases. Here's the asbestos cases. Here's prior verdicts in the Virgin Islands. You know, here's prior verdicts in Florida. Like, here's the potential. Here's the benefits of our jurisdiction. And guess what? I got a lot of no's. I mean, I think I went through the whole list and some. So I had 150 phone calls. No, 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 no. And at that point I went, okay, let me go one more time. But this time I'm going to ask them, can they recommend anybody? And so I did the whole calling again. And at that point, each person, I try to get like just one or two recommendations. And then I called those law firms. And I was able to get my asbestos cases backed. It took 8 or 9 months of doing the calls. And then for my tobacco cases, I mean, this is just serendipity. I had already filed one of my cases where the plaintiff had told me he'd given free cigarettes. He'd grown up in the Virgin Islands. His father was killed in the military. And so his mother sent him up to his grandmother's in the Bronx. And, you know, and he's like 9 years old. And he talked about coming home from school and they would put little four packs on the doorknobs. And he was on a 5-story walk up. So four rooms on each floor. So there was 20 packs of cigarettes, four packs. And it was happening like once a week or once every 2 weeks for over a year. And so he'd come home, you know, to his little housing project. And he'd see that, and as a 9-year-old, he's super excited. He'd collect them all and then go hide them down in the basement boiler room. And, you know, that got him popular at school, and he started smoking. And I thought, this is crazy. Like, they're giving away free cigarettes. And at that time, I type it into whatever, Google, and it turns out there's a trial in Massachusetts, the first tobacco case ever in Massachusetts. And the story is, woman who grew up in the projects in Boston, same thing. They put four packs on their doorknob. So I call them up, and they're like, hey, we're in trial right now. And I said, well, look, I've got a witness that could testify to the four packs. And they're like, well, he's not on our witness list, so we couldn't do it in trial. I'm like, well, what about rebuttal? You know, I'll fly him up there if you need us for rebuttal. And when I say fly, I'm like, I have no money at that time. So, I mean, this is like just more credit card expense, but I knew I was gonna do it and get up there and do whatever it took. They didn't need it, but it turned out it was the Marie Evans case. And they had a huge verdict, and the guy who did it was just like me, but he was an older lawyer. He was doing kind of just boutique litigation in a mid-sized firm that did plaintiff and defense, and he'd taken this for kind of a malpractice case and put tobacco companies in it because she smoked. And it was, again, kind of serendipity, just kind of naivety, but passion and determination, like never giving up. And it was Michael Weissman who opened up Massachusetts now. And that's really the epicenter of tobacco cases. And I have to give one shout out too to Professor Dick Daynard. He's the godfather of tobacco litigation. And from the early 70s, Dick Daynard, after that, backed my cases in the Virgin Islands, which, you know, you asked me, I filed those in 210. We didn't get them tried until after our two Cat 5 hurricanes in 2017, Irma and Maria. We call them a Cat 10, Irma Maria. So 2018, we finally had the trial on those two cases. And I really compliment the judge, Judge Michael Dunstan. He was very creative. We'd asked to consolidate the cases and have two plaintiffs in one trial. And the defense, I mean, they object. They hate that. I mean, they object out the wazoo, even though consolidation is used all across the country in asbestos and products liability. You know, tobacco's like, oh, well, we're unique. We're so unique. You can't possibly do this. And the judge said, well, how about this? When you're talking about general causation and things like addiction, we'll have both juries seated. And then when you're talking about the injuries for one person, then we'll seat one jury. And so we actually had two juries in, you know, 80% of the case is the same stuff. So two juries sat 80% of the time. And then when we went into like individual injuries, one jury had a day off. And, It came back, the two juries came back with their verdicts, and you know, one jury was $31 million, and the other jury was $83 million, so $113 total. And of course, it's appealed. And in 2022, we finally got paid. The verdicts were cut down some, but you know, it still was a huge win.
12 years later, is that right?
It feels like yesterday, but yes.
Time flies when you have a fun. Yeah. How about asbestos?
So same thing on that, you know, the refinery in the Virgin Islands is kind of a study on, I don't think there's any other way to put it at that point in time, a study on
mass
class
poisoning
and racism. And I mean, the reason it's built in the Virgin Islands somewhat is that it's as far away as possible from kind of the EPA and OSHA and MSHA that you could be. And it was packed with asbestos, you know, when they built that in the late 60s. And then they would bring in labor from, there wasn't enough labor in the Virgin Islands to support it. So they had a very liberal policy of importing labor from down island, you know, all the other islands below us, St. Lucia, Trinidad, Dominica. And these guys that came to work it were very excited. They're very motivated, but they weren't educated. I mean, they grew up on, with their parents being farmers and kind of like fruit or banana plantations. And they were brought in on what's called bond. So they weren't American citizens. And when you were fired, they pretty much were like, you're out of here. 48 hours, grab your stuff, you're out. So these guys were really, I mean, absolute yes men. You know, whatever they were told to do, they did it. It didn't matter how dirty, how dangerous, you know, climb that tower 100 feet with no harness, dig something out of the top of it. They did it, and they'd have, you know, families in the Virgin Islands. So they'd end up, you know, marrying a woman, having American citizens as their children, and with this threat hanging over their head any second that if they said no to a supervisor, that they'd get their pink slip and they had to get out, you know, back to St. Lucia in 48 hours and never see their family again. So it just was, and they were never told about, you know, they were never told about the asbestos, what they were doing. And we built a pretty damning evidence out of this for trial. So we actually have never tried one of the asbestos cases. It takes forever to get a trial. Just the courts are kind of slow in the Virgin Islands. And you know, you get closer and then you get a Segway pulled over here or this or something happens. You have a hurricane or the power goes out or you know, we have just something happens. And then when we finally can get a trial and we can hold a trial date, there's that come to Jesus moment from the defense where, you know, you settle the weekend before trial.
Right, but our mutual friend, Scott Frost, he tries a lot of cases. He tries like three, four asbestos cases a year, mm-hmm. which is like, and you know, he tells me like it's such a hard job because every one of his clients has got a death sentence, mm-hmm. basically. So very emotionally draining stuff.
Well, I always say, you know, your plaintiffs really are your heroes. Because anybody that you're picking up that's already dying, you know, they're not only at their worst. I mean, physically, mentally, they are drained. And you're asking them now, I need you to remember all of this stuff. And then I need you to endure the cross-examination, you know, the punishment that the defendants are going to give you. When most people are just like, I would like to die in peace. So, I mean, they're not. And, you know, the whole issue of civil law is that you're trying to make a safer world for the future. It's deterrence. You know, it's you can't say full compensation for somebody who is going to die a horrible, painful death from mesothelioma. Like, there is no amount of money. You can give them $1 billion and they're going to say, no, thank you. I would like to not die this horrible death. So it has to be deterrence that, hey, my children and grandchildren will live in a safer world if I bring this case. And, you know, Nick Rally had talked about that in one of his books where he talks about that courts have stopped using deterrence, and it's like, oh, it's just a full trade for all harms caused. It's fair and reasonable compensation to make the plaintiff whole. Okay, but that's only like one pedal on the bicycle. And so in Nick Rally's book, he had a bunch of Iowa case law that if you go back 200 years ago, the judges are all like, no, it's not only full paying full compensation, but if you are forced to pay full compensation, then all these bad actors will be deterred from doing it again. And so I have briefing on that. I'm always happy to share it. And I've sent it out. I know I sent it back to Nick Rally and his team, but I've got a lot of briefing that I go through old case law from all 50 states, and it's old. I mean, you grew in the 50s, the 1920s, the 1800s, but it exists where the courts are like, yes, civil compensatory damages have a deterrence effect. And we got to get that back into our jury instructions. So I know you'll have my email in your podcast.
Well, why don't you, I was going to say, I still want to talk about, you know, the final things I want to talk to you about are, you know, the trial that you recently did down in your home island there. But if people want to get a hold of you, because, you know, because I know you're working with my buddy Kimball Jones on tobacco cases in
Las Vegas,
and you're always looking for new wrongs that are out there that, you know, for just like this, I mean, you know, who else is bringing, not many other people are bringing these cases or putting these cases together, so.
Yeah, tobacco cases, they can be done in a lot of states. I mean, California can be revived. I don't want to go into the technical details on this podcast because, I mean, this is...
You know, we have a whole other podcast just on tobacco litigation. So anybody that's interested in tobacco litigation, we'll get you a whole new podcast so that you understand the roadmap and how, you know, Russ goes about putting these things together, which is just like, you know... You may not be as smart as your dad, but you're definitely smart and have the ability to focus more than most people that I know.
Join me and my mentor, David Clark, May 27th through June 2nd in Huntington Beach, California for a dark arts boot camp. This program will change your life. Dave will teach you about neurolinguistic programming, conversational hypnosis, embedding stories in the unconscious mind. He changed my life and he'll change yours. And I'll coach you on your witness prep and direct, cross-examination, performance skills for opening statement and closing argument, and voir dire. These days will change your life. Come for the boot camp, stay for TLU Beach, the greatest conference ever.
So how do people get a hold of you?
So the cell phone 340, Virgin Islands area code 690. That's the old school cell phone number intro, 7283. So 7283, that's my last name, P-A-T-E. So send me a text. And then the email is Pate, P-A-T-E, at Sun, S-U-N, Law, L-A-W, V-I for Virgin Islands. Pate at sunlawvi.com.
All right. So you mentioned Nick Rowley. And your first TLU big conference was Caesars Palace 2024. First of all, how did you find TLU?
I don't know. I mean, I always want to learn. Now that I've been practicing longer, I work with different stateside councils as co-counsel. And the first thing I do is I find out who their associates are on the team, and I send them my five books. It's like the Old Testament Pentateuch or whatever. These are the basic books you got to know. You got to know Rules of the Road by Friedman. You've got to know Advanced Depositions. You got to know Polarizing the Case. The 30B6 by Mark
Kazurowski,
just call him Kaz. And then David Ball on damages. And that is your Bible for starting out.
Advanced Deposition, is that Philip Miller?
Yeah, these are the giants. The Mousetrap, Philip Miller, you've got to know the Mousetrap. And like kids that are out of law school, I would be like, if you have a law firm right now and you are hiring anybody, you need to assign one book every semester, every quarter, they need to be reading those five books. Absolutely, bar none, basic education. And if they don't know the boxing in, the Mousetrap, how to polarize, because most people are terrified on their cases, like, oh, they're beating up on my plaintiff and they're making him look so horrible. When you understand polarizing the case, you are happy about that. You are very happy they are attacking your plaintiff, and you keep pushing them out on that scale, out on that cliff as far as you can. And I call it tightening the bow. Like they're pulling that bow back that when they finally let go, you're gonna shoot that arrow of damages so far. That's where you take little cases and get big damages from, is because the defense is just rabid dog against you with no rationality. It's all lost and you need to embrace that. Don't fear it. But TLU, yes. I don't know how I know I found it because I always want to get better. And at that point, I came out to Vegas. It's a little overwhelming for me. You know, the Virgin Islands is a very small place. We don't have, like, our tallest building, maybe three stories. You know, it's a small town. And you're living in, like, a little place of, like, it's 50,000 people, but it feels like 10 in St. Croix. So I come to Vegas, and you know, you're really, you have brought in like the top talent from everywhere. You can learn every, there's no bad session to go to. And I really appreciated that. There was a session on Voidire or Voidire, and you had Nick Rally and Arash Amanpour. And I love the juxtaposition that was there, because Arash Amanpour is, I mean, just the most polished, just classically trained jury selection. And if you're starting out, you learn that. You need, like, if you could do what he do, oh my God, it was amazing. And then Nick is like, he's pushing the envelope. I mean, he is doing things that you really can't do. And I like to push the envelope. I've definitely done it. But you can't push the envelope until you've mastered the basics, like how to do it right. And then, I mean, you've got, I mean, just amazing people. I mean, you, like Michael Hill talks about nobody, you know, he had done nursing home cases, and he's like, nobody cares about the injury. Like, no one cares. It's the why. It's the systemic failure. If this is not stopped, your children are, like, how to get into the jury box. If this conduct, this systemic failure is not stopped, one of your family members will be injured. So it's not about how hurt your client is. And that's the same thing back to doctors and everybody else. They see people crushed all the time, whatever. And you know, you look at, and just, there's just so many great people you've brought together. I like Kirk Zahner lately, because he talked about his loss. If you're not losing, then you're not trying enough cases. And I mean, I tried, you know, my first couple cases that I did try in the Virgin Islands were losses or like low verdicts, very disappointing, like below settlement value. And they're crushing. You're like, oh, just like you said, your ego gets crushed. But I think if there's anything in life, it's just never give up. It's the most simple thing ever. And I tell that to my son a lot. He's 2.5. And the most pride I ever had lately was he looked at me and said, Dada, I did this. I didn't give up. I didn't give up. And I'm like, oh my God. And I'm like almost crying. Like, there it is. Don't give up.
Resilience.
Yeah. Just keep going.
Resilience is so critical, because it's going to be, I was at Panish's conference. He has his own little PSR conference. And it was, you know, honestly, like, it was great because it was in a beautiful place, Ojai, but like they're like the firm that operates across the board at the highest level. And he brought the speaker in, and I'm not really big on motivational speakers, because if you're not motivated, nobody's going to help you.
Yeah.
But this guy's like, to be successful, you need three things. You need focus. So you got to figure out, what the hell do you want? That's focus. And then the next thing is passion. How badly do you want it? Because that'll dictate how hard you work on it. If you want to get there in 10 years, well, you're going to work at a little different pace than if you got to get there in 6 months. And then finally is resilience or mental toughness. Because on the road to greatness, on the road to success, there's going to be setbacks. And if you can't handle setbacks, if they actually set you back, you'll never get there.
Yeah.
And so you got to be mentally tough. You got to be resilient. And, you know, I mean, you, like, resilience, you know, just doing the type of cases you do besides the persistence. But speaking of the cases, so you just recently, because I know you just called me about, was it maybe two weeks ago, because you just finished your trial.
Yeah, we had a, so it was, I mean, you call it like a slip and fall, but it was a fall over a low railing. So in St. Thomas, it's a very like mountainous island. And so there's a lot of buildings on the side of the hill. It's a restaurant, overlooks the bay, the harbor. And to get in and out, there's a main, you know, nice like rock stairway. And the building is old from the 50s, and it had a very low wall and handrail. And so the client had been walking up that stairway, and some children had come around on the top. He'd stepped to the side and tripped over and fallen over the railing and fell and, you know, would have died. I mean, he was urgently taken to the hospital and airlifted off, but he'd burst fractured his L1 and had a spinal fusion and then had a basal skull fracture. So when the case came in, it was, the case came in as, you know, spinal fusion and that, you know, a premises liability case. And this is why it's important to be always training, because, you know, you have to always be doing more work. You are your advocate for your client. So on this, I when I brought the case in, I went, I need to look at this from a TBI angle. I mean, he hit his head, brain injury, but our client, I mean, he made like the most remarkable recovery. Every doctor was like, this is a 1 in 1,000 recovery. You know, he'd had his spine surgery, he'd been up in the States, he came back, he started work again, kind of office worker. and got back to, he did all this physical rehab and therapy and was back in the gym, out walking. He was in his early 60s. So it was a strange case where you have this amazing, amazing recovery. And you do want that for your clients. I mean, attorneys get a bad name when you're like, you want the people the most messed up. No, you every case that comes in, you want the best for your client and to do the best you can for them. And so we ended up, making a policy limit demand on that and a couple times. And of course, the offers were extremely low.
What was the policy?
$2 million.
And what was the highest offer prior to trial?
Until the bad faith comes out, let's just say very low. Yeah.
All right, very low. Nothing you could consider.
Yeah, and you got to realize, for anybody trying a case, people are always, this case has all these flaws. Well, if your case is going to trial, it obviously has problems. So there is no case ever that's going to trial that doesn't have warts and flaws. That's why you're the lawyer. You have to figure out how to frame it. Like that's where the rubber hits the road. So if you're talking with other lawyers that are like, my case has all these problems and I'm so worried. And like, yes, that's why your case is going to trial. That's why you need to be, learning from other people. That's how you need to be evaluating the angles, how you're going to frame it. So our case, had a ton of problems. I mean, he was at a bar. He was drinking. When he was taken to the hospital, he had a 0.22 blood alcohol. He'd also been an insurance representative who'd evaluated that property for, structural, earth, wind, fire, water, hurricane damage. And the defense then are like, he also looked at liability, and it became a contested issue. We had a very difficult Dram Shop Act. The Virgin Islands adopted back 10 or 12, 13 years ago, Florida's Dram Shop Law, which is pretty much you can get people as drunk as you want, and you have no liability. You just send people out, hammered into the world, and whatever happens then is not your fault. So we really were when you're trying that case, it's a very thin line that we can't talk about over service of alcohol at all, even though the bartender and the restaurant had served him, four glasses of wine, a tequila shot, and topped up his wine glasses. It had to be the dangerous condition itself. So there was just a bunch of things that you have to overcome. And a lot of that is how you frame it. And so for the alcohol, we ended up framing it from the perspective of the lay witnesses. And this is what's so important. I mean, this is what you learn from TLU, that everybody's going to have their medical experts. But if you can pull in the lay witnesses, even if it's such a short bit of testimony, you have people who have no interest in the case and a short testimony. And this is Satch Oliver on Depositions or Trial. You get these little vignettes. And so we work very, we had the bartender testify, and she'd known him before, that he looked just fine. And that, he at the bar, and when he went up and he forgot his credit card and came back down the steps. And we didn't know exactly what she was going to say, because she still isn't kind of our witness. But we had a feeling that if we ask her if somebody looked intoxicated, would you not let them drive? What would you do? And so this was a calculated open-ended question. And we asked, if somebody looked like that they were too intoxicated, to drive or whatever else, what would you do? Well, I would get my manager, or I would call a taxi. She gave like two or three things. And that's looped into closing later. He had a friend there who was actually his boss at the bar and that knows him. And it's like, your employee, your friend. Did he seem intoxicated to you, that he couldn't walk or that he couldn't drive? No. And then there was another person who was down on her honeymoon and really had no connection, except that she'd talk with my client, while they were having like appetizers and drinking. And it was a bit to find this woman, but the defense ended up finding her before the trial and doing a deposition. And in our questioning of the deposition, which was read at trial later, was, did he look like he couldn't walk, or that he was extremely inebriated, or that he couldn't drive? And this person, this woman's like, no, he seemed fine to me. And so the defense, all they had was their medical experts, their paid medical experts that they flew down from the States to say, he was a 0.22. That's extremely intoxicated. And so your cross, we didn't cross them very hard. We just crossed them back. Isn't it true that alcohol affects people differently, and that some people with more resistance who maybe are their social drinkers, we admitted our client was a social drinker. When he finished work, he would go have a few. That's his routine with friends.
Okay, Russ, 0.22, social drinker.
He's very social.
Yeah.
Because I used to do a lot of DUI defense in 0.22. And I used to test myself on like a breathalyzer, you know, cause just for my understanding, but like, that's a lot. That's not like a couple glasses of wine.
Yeah, but that's when you're leaning in on that, yes.
Right.
You know, you're admitting the fact because you have people that are on the ground there that know him and they're like, no, he looked fine. And so we're leaning in on the lay witnesses while theirs are just like, you know, this is this number. And you're using a gentle crossback to be like, well, some people have higher alcohol resistance, correct? Some people are lower. And you just get that out and then you're able to put it back into your closing to say, look, we have three people with eyes on the ground that night who were there. They were there. They saw it with their own eyes. They came in here and testified to you honestly and truthfully. And they've flown down the defense and you frame it, you know, the restaurant has a name, but you want to use the corporate name. So I always refer to in the trial by the corporate name. Bowline Hospitality 3 LLC. You know, they flew down these doctors. I'm sure they're great doctors and, you know, they had to shut down their practices and they probably cost a ton of money to shut their practices down. And they came all the way down here to sit in this chair and tell you that he had 0.22. But we know that. They didn't see him. They don't know anything. They didn't listen to the testimony of the witnesses that were there.
So, and what's exciting, Russ, is that after you came to Caesar's Palace, you were in Huntington Beach last summer. So for people that maybe been to Caesar's Palace or been to my Vegas conference, because I've done a few of them there, and hadn't been to the beach, how would you compare the Huntington Beach experience to the Las Vegas experience?
Well, what you do at, you know, Huntington Beach is like such a special location there. It just has that California like holistic feel that it's just like a much more human environment. It's smaller. You've just created a vibe that just feels so Southern California.
And we buy out the whole hotel.
Yeah.
So everybody in the hotel is with us. So it makes it more like a kind of like a college dorm experience. Mm-hmm. And the food's fantastic. And, you know, I think because of the interactions and it's being smaller, it just feels so much more connected. Plus you get fresh air every break, every breakfast is outside. Mm-hmm. And the food's fantastic on the ocean lawn. And then the lunches and, you know, just, I mean, I love, like, this is our fifth year in that same location, and people are like, gonna change it up. You need a bigger place. You mm-hmm. have all these people. I'm like, I don't need a bigger place. I need a place that's, this is perfect, because there's room for so much more people than the 250 rooms of the hotel. And that's why we got the Hilton and I think the Marriott right next door and nearby. So those are the overflows. Those are beautiful hotels. You know, you just don't have the vibe of just being at, like, you know, being almost back in college with a bunch of college friends. You know, you're on the elevator, people. It's easy to say, hey, where are you from? You know, or like you might even recognize them too, because, you know, with the workshops and stuff and people doing Zoom meetups ahead of time. And, you know, and my idea too is like to create little brain trusts for folks, right? So like Joe Fried and Joe Kammerling are teaching a one-day specialized mm-hmm. day, and not just trucking, but on trucking versus Amazon and FedEx, these carriers that subcontract out and trying to take responsibility and avoid accountability for it. So just doing one day on that, or like Michael Hill, somebody's really focused on, you know, so anybody that's in that group though, the 30 or 40 lawyers in that group, they're gonna have their little micro brain trust on how to litigate these things at the highest level, because these fellas are doing it. And same thing with Michael Hill, like on the nursing home stuff. And, you know, because like, or Dale Gallipo on civil rights, these people have figured out their lane at the highest level and then, you know, willing to share it. Because, like, I think since COVID, people are much more open and sharing than they used to be. I don't know why. I think because you realize we all need each other. I mean, this is a tough business, it's a lonely world. So
if we can't, I mean, that should be our advantage. We're smaller, you know, plaintiff lawyers, we're small shops, and the defense lawyers are very jealous. They jealously guard their big clients.
Of each other.
And here for us, it should be a rising tide lifts all boats. And ooh, you've really put together, I mean, this is the, you know, I think of the dream team from the 90s. I mean, you got Michael Jordan. I mean, it's like you're being taught by LeBron James. These people are the best. And I even like Ben Rabinowitz. I did his classes and
last year?
Yeah, and
he signed up again for this year.
I'm signed up for
with
this
Mike
year
Kelly
too.
And Ben.
And his closings are great because he uses rhetorical questions.
Right.
You know, and it's a rhetorical question to the jury where their mind is screaming back the answer yes. You've never told them anything. What world do you want to live in? a world where everyone is safe, or where no one is safe? You never had to say anything. I mean, who's choosing number two? But he does it in, I mean, it's such, it's, no one wants to feel that anything is forced upon them, particularly the jury. And that, I mean, it's so, I have such a hard time. I am too direct on the jury. And after doing that session with Ben Rabinowitz, I tried really hard this last trial to tone it back and end with a few rhetorical questions. And that's how I started the closing. You know, I used to think it's so trite to get up and thank the jury, but it's not. So I start now, you get up and you give the jury a thank you to their importance. You know, you saw them taking notes. You saw them actively engaged. You saw them really thinking and watching the witnesses and their demeanor. And that matters because my client only has one chance. He never gets to come back here again. One chance for the rest of his life. And you're taking this seriously, and I can never give you enough thanks for that. And we just had a big, what they call State of the Union, but State of the Territory. So just behind our courthouse is like a, you know, the legislative body. And when we were Monday picking a jury, the governor gives his big speech. So I referred to the Senate or legislative body. I said, you know, on Monday when you're getting picked for jury, the governor spoke to all the senators, all the judges, you know, all the important people in the Virgin Islands. And I said, but what you're doing here, is it more important than all those people over there? And then you go into the binary choice because you've got, this is the polarizing. And I stand over, my client was actually not in the courtroom for the closing, and I'll tell you why later, but I stand over by our desk and say, you are having a choice whether safety exists in the Virgin Islands for everyone, and then I walk toward the defense side, or there's no safety for no one.
We're starting off the summer right. May 8th and 9th in Hermosa Beach, California at the TLU Beach House. We're doing a two-day witness prep and direct examination workshop. You will learn how to prepare your clients so they just don't remember their stories, but they relive them. And then we transition that to direct examination so the jury just doesn't hear the story, but they relive them. They experience them. They witness them. We'll see you there.
And that's it. That's your choice. You answer A or B. There's no middle ground.
Well, the great news is, Russ, is that you, in TLU Huntington Beach, June 2nd through 6th, it says 3 through 6, but if you come on the 2nd, you can go to surf camp or you can go play pickleball, and we're having a dinner that night, buying out the restaurant for guess how many people? 300.
Jeez.
It's not by, it's not, it's, there's 300. There was a movie made about 300 warriors that saved civilization. That's the group that shows up there that night. But you're gonna give a 1 hour live case analysis about this trial, which I'm very stoked about. And you know, the great thing too is like everything's recorded, right? At Travelers University, all these different tracks. So when these people come in and give their brilliance, whether it's Panish, whether it's Raleigh, whether it's, you know, Freed or Mitnick or McGinn, it's preserved for and accessible through TLU On Demand, which is, you know, critical because, you know, because I always think if I was coming there, I would simply do more workshops, do things that are interactive, get on your feet, meet people, take a risk, get outside your comfort zone. All the stuff that you can learn from a lecture, you can watch on a video and get the same, I mean, get the same knowledge. Obviously, you don't have the interaction with the speaker or with the other students who are learning the same thing. So that is a miss, but there's nothing like being in the small groups with an instructor like Michael Hill or Joe Freed, that's actually like, it's not just that they're teaching a small group, but it, by its very nature, attracts that nucleus of really focused people, you know, almost like I say, a brain trust is what my goal is to do.
Well, and you give them a choice. I mean, that's the best thing,
right,
about your program is, you know, you have a choice of doing the lecture tracks or getting your hands dirty. And I think it's a combination. You need to have a little bit of both. Right. And that's, I'm excited on you know, the case analysis, one of the things I'll talk about is what I call, I give the Lady Liberty closing, and I don't know if anybody else quite does it, but you know, I walk through the symbolism of Lady Liberty, Lady Justice, Lady Justice closing. And you know, you tell the jury, you are Lady Justice, and you know, she has her blindfold, and I use a little bit of how voir dire or voir dire, that's the blindfold, that everybody who came in is coming in blindfolded, and we don't have like attorney-led questioning. So I have to, I have questions I submit to the judge. She doesn't answer all of them. But like one important question is there any person in the jury that would have a cap on their damages? So I bring that up at the beginning of the trial after I give them the thank you. I kind of give the empowerment. I go to the binary choice. And then I say, you have a job to do. And I mean, this is all TLU. You know, you empower the jurors. They have a job, a very important job. And I go, and you know what? It's not a job that any human being has done this job. You are, from your collective experience, which is probably 300 years of collective experience in this jury box, Lady Justice is going to show you how to do it. And you're Lady Justice. So you go to the blindfold, and I come back with the questioning because I couldn't use it earlier. It's the judge doing it, and people are just so tired. You know, they raise their card. I go, the judge asks you, and you, just like you're practicing here at boot camp, your movements are very deliberate. So when I say the judge, you know, I'm looking over, I'm moving my arm, it's congruent. I'm making eye contact with the judge.
And everybody looks at the judge.
They all look at the judge. You're empowering that jury that it's not just you saying that this law or this rule. This is the judge, the court. And I go, and that judge asks you, does anybody have a cap on damages? And all of you in this jury said, no, you put on the blindfold of justice. And if you go back in your jury room and somebody says, well, I just couldn't award that much, you remind them. They took an oath as a juror to follow the law, and they said there was no cap. And if they still say that, you need to write a note to the judge. So you need to empower the other judges to wrangle in your bad jurors. And then I go through, you know, we go down to the scales of justice, and you explain that with Lady Justice, and that it's not a criminal case, you know, it's not beyond a reasonable doubt. And I use different, you know, usually I use a glass of orange juice, that the orange juice you can see is a little over full. And I go, this orange juice has proved its case. It's just a little over full. That's all it needed to prove that it's orange juice. I use a football field or a soccer field on the 51st yard line. I don't have to take the ball in the end zone. When I got to 51, we've won the case. And then you go down to, usually Lady Justice has a snake. She's got her foot on the book, and there's a snake, and she's crushing the snake. And I talk about that as the snake is lies, deceit, you know, falsehoods. And you as a jury, as normal human beings, you've been doing this your whole life, ferreting out people who are truthful and people who are liars. And now you're doing it in this case. And you know how to do it. You've got to crush that snake. And then I like using Nick Rally's righteous justice, because this is righteous justice. And then you get to the book, and that's going to be your jury instructions. You're going to follow that book, and then you bring it to the sword, because you got to swing that sword. And you can't swing that sword until you've got your blindfold on. You've weighed the scales of justice, you've crushed the snake, you've followed the law, and 5 out of 6 of you have to pick up that sword. It takes 5 out of 6, and you're going to swing it. And you're going to either swing it at my client, and name your client, or you're going to swing it at the defendant, Acme Corporation 3 LLC. But you can't not swing it.
Russ, here's my question that nobody knows the answer to. What was the verdict?
It was $7 million with 10% fault, so $6.3 million. And a big deal, you know, on damages, again, I'll give Nick Rally a shout out on this. Our instructions in the Virgin Islands are damages should be fair and reasonable. And what I always think is, you know, it's supposed to be, you hear in law school and everything, it's supposed to be a full trade for all harm's cause. So I give a whole kind of
full trade
education, yeah, that it's got to be a full trade for all harm's caused. So if it's not a full trade, then how can it be fair? And if it's not fair, how can it be reasonable? And I usually, you know, look at a juror and you say, so if you gave someone $100 and they gave you 90 back, well, that's not full, is it? So it's not fair. So it's not reasonable, right? So here we're looking at a full trade for all harms caused. And then I closed with I used the briefcase example. And then at the end, I bring back righteous justice, because I really think, you know, people want to come out of there. And I used a little bit of, you know, this verdict is going to last for all time. You know, that your grandchildren can come here and open up this verdict and say, look, my grandmother stood for safety in the Virgin Islands. Not just safety here, but safety for every person. Young, old, tourist, local, you know, sober, maybe intoxicated, everyone.
And the great news, Russ, is that anybody that can't make your case analysis, well, they can watch it on TLU on demand, because it's going to be recorded. But with that, we have to just finish this with one rhetorical question. You know what that is? if you're not at TLU Beach, you just have to ask yourself one question. You know what that is? Why the fuck not?
I was going to end with, if anybody wants any travel advice for the Virgin Islands, my little favorites, then send me a text or an email. I'm always happy to.
That's a way to end too.
Give you some advice, because you need to enjoy life too. I mean, you've got a hard life already, but if you're not plugging in and staying human and staying healthy, you've got to have your brain and body working.
That's why I'm moving from Vegas to Hermosa Beach, because I got to take care of my brain. And the sunshine and ocean is going to be much better than the desert and isolation, for sure. And if you don't have TLU on demand and you want to test it out, shoot me a text or email, and I'll shoot you a complimentary access code so you can, because we collect all the pleadings, transcripts, and PowerPoints for all these cases and all these presentations. And it's an app for your phone, which means you can learn anytime, anywhere, and never stop learning, which is very important.
And speaking of sharing stuff, I've also got a whole brief on asking for damages at trial. There's, some states like Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, you can't ask for some certain. So I put that all together because I reversed the law in the Virgin Islands.
Oh, yeah, because I forgot to mention, this guy's a politician, too. I mean,
I'm
just
trying.
Crazy. He's like, you got to take the discipline because you're making a lot of money and set all that money making time aside and go do public service and be part of the legislature and be part of the people protecting the community. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, if you were a plaintiff lawyer, at some point, the laws are only as good as they are. You have to get into the local legislature. And it's like, if you're doing really well, it's going to be a pay cut. So if you're a big firm, then I hope you can find one person in your firm that has the political leanings and fund them. But, we're going to lose it. At some point, if they take away all of our tools, and this goes back to, we're in Nick Rally's house right now, just because we've donated to the fund against Uber. So what Uber is trying to do, and I hate this, this is caps on attorney's fees. So New Jersey has like a 33% cap. So it makes it very hard for me to bring tobacco cases in New Jersey because the cases are so risky and intensive and take so long. Why would somebody fight for somebody at such a low rate when the risk is so great? And I think if we could get more, I think we need law students writing about this. What defendants are doing by plaintiff attorney caps is to take away the champions of the people. So just think of it this way. Imagine if plaintiff lawyers went and said, we want to put a cap through every state legislature that defense attorneys can only charge $100. That's it. I don't care if you're Microsoft, Google, Exxon, Chevron, your general counsel can't be paid with stock benefits. They can't be paid with options. They can't be paid $20 million a year. They can only make $100 an hour. And your Skadden Arps, your Kirkland and Ellis lawyers that are billing $2,500 an hour, they can only make $100 an hour. That's what they're trying. That's what Uber is trying to do to plaintiff lawyers. Because right now, corporations are kings. They are the kings of old Europe. And when the king needs an army, how do you get an army to fight? You pay them. You pay your army. You feed them and you pay them. And if the servants and the peasants and the yeomen and the farmers, who's their army? They don't have money. So your champion who's coming out has to fund his horse and his sword and his shield. And the only way he can do that is if he can recover in that fight. He can recover in that fight against injustice something. Because we live in a society that the whole idea of capitalism is, hey, not only can you do good, you can go out and use hard work and your ideas and you can make the world a better place. And guess what? People will pay you to do that because you did such a great service. It's a valuable service. And the idea of capping attorney's fees on the plaintiff side is the idea of ending service for the poor, the disenfranchised, the widow, the orphan, the injured. It's insidious. But that's the back way to cut our feet out. Because when you have justice on your side and you can go to court and win and actually then win and make enough money that you can go do it again for somebody else who's hurt. Because all lawyers, you have a war chest. You're putting the money together for your client. Every successful plaintiff lawyer has to have a war chest. You're funding the war for your poor, your huddled masses. And once the defendants can take away the war chest, they've won the war with never firing a shot.
Well, Russ, that's not going to happen because we recognize the fight and we're taking the fight to them.
And we got to get more lawyers, plaintiff lawyers in the legislature, that lawyers for the people. That's it.
All right. Thanks, Russ. The time to go skiing now.
Let's ski.
Big Sky. Here we come.
Ready to train with the Titans and set records with your verdicts? Register for our live conferences and boot camps at TrialLawyersUniversity.com. Start getting your reps in before the big event by going to TLUOnDemand.com to gain instant access to live lectures, case analysis, and skills training videos from the trial lawyer champions you love and respect, as well as pleadings, transcripts, PowerPoints, and notes for a roadmap to victory. Join the group that continues to get extraordinary results. Trial Lawyers University, produced and powered by LawPods.